The podcast for the inquisitive diver.
Okay, first of all, Nace, welcome to the show, buddy. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm good. How are you?
Oh, not too shabby. A bit bloody cold, but I'm sure this coffee will warm me up nicely.
Well, it's the way it is in Australia. You just got to suck up the cold.
Oh, it's ridiculous, isn't it? Apparently, we're going to have a load of flooding. A load of rains come in, and you know what that means to our diving.
Not again. Yeah. Been there, done that.
Yeah, yeah, too many times. But it is where it is. Hey. Nace, why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure thing. So my name is Nace. I'm an independent filmmaker and an underwater cameraman. I live in Sydney, and I specialize in all sorts of things from, you know, long-form documentaries about divers to short-form underwater content, as well as also photography. And I feel really lucky to, you know, kind of have like that perfect yin and yang balance for all those things, whether it's diving and film or free diving and rebreathers. Just, it's very humbling to wake up every day and realize that you get to do what you love and, you know, reach for the stars, I suppose.
Where did it all start? Because, I mean, you're quite young, aren't you? How old are you? It's like I'm getting a flashback. I had Stephen Fordyce on the show last week, and he's got baby face. And then here you.
Yeah, I'd like to joke that I'm a 45-year-old in the body of a 25-year-old.
Okay.
So it really all began about nearly 20 years ago where in the school that I went to, they had this library where we would just go bananas with everything that we read. And I remember coming home from school one day that had with about a dozen books on sharks and whales. And my parents immediately took note of that. And I was also really interested in Star Wars at the time, like every boy that age is. And there were these two swirling passions of, you know, marine biology in one corner and then movies and magic on the other one. So my next birthday, my grandmother gave me the 4-disc special edition copy of The Blue Planet, the David Attenborough series, which we all know and love. And I will never forget the day where I sat through all the episodes as well as the making of. Now, the thing that appealed to me was not just like the, you know, exquisite imagery, storytelling, music, and all this stuff, but what really captivated me was the making of documentary, where they would show all the cameramen who were, I'll never forget, they were wearing rebreathers, they were using really fancy cameras, and there was one scene in Cocos and Galapagos where they were just surrounded by a colossal school of about 200 plus hammerhead sharks, I think, and then about 1,000 silky sharks. And I remember putting my hand up saying, I want to do that when I'm older. But I was about 7 years old at the time, so too young to do an open water. So I had to wait a little bit before I could really get into it. So I eventually did get to do my open water, actually here in Sydney, where the water's it was quite murky, cold, and dark at the time because I did my course in the middle of winter. So it was a little different to what I had expected, obviously having seen those, you know, tropical environments. But I didn't really get back into it until after I left school, which is when a classmate of mine needed someone to shoot the underwater scenes for her film. And given that I had already spent a lot of years in high school just like getting the hang of filmmaking and realizing that's what I wanted to do. And this was kind of like, there was almost like this voice in my head saying, this is a chance to make these two passions like come together. So I put my hand up and I said, let's do it. And we show up at Avalon Beach in the middle of the winter with really violent swells, but the water is crystal clear. And the moment my finger hit the shutter of the GoPro as we were filming this scene, I could feel a much bigger click reverberate inside me. And it was kind of like that realization of, oh my goodness, this is what I've been looking for all this time. And I've been addicted to shooting underwater ever since.
Mm-hmm. So when was that?
That gig was 2016, May, it's June 1st, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you're still on the early path of your career in filmmaking and underwater filmmaking, et cetera, aren't you?
Yes.
However, done rather well with Descent.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's very clearly well done because you've got several awards for it now, eh?
Yes, it's kind of surprised me how it did better than I thought it would be because it was my first ever feature film, and I was just happy with the first festival was the Sydney Film Festival, which we later won, but I was just happy to, you know, even be selected for that in the first place. And then when it went on to, you know, several European and Asian festivals, I was really chuffed to see it kind of have a life outside of Australia.
Yeah, yeah. What was the push? Was mum and dad giving you a push? Go on, you can do it.
What do you think about that?
Well, you know, because to start filming and then trying to get it onto the big stage, and you know, again, I say that you're a young lad. It's very impressive to get it on. So there must have been some kind of support in the background there to give you the bumps when you started to feel any kind of brick walls or hazards that come along the way.
Well, the thing is that I don't come from a family of either filmmakers or divers at all. In fact, I'm pretty much the only person in the entire family who will swim in anything more than a meter deep. But essentially, because I had been, you know, I had returned to diving a few years before I made that film, and I had gotten used to a lot of challenging conditions, that kind of installed a lot of resilience. And like it, because when you're in the ocean, as and you probably have experienced this too, is you really learn how to be self-sufficient when you're at the mercy of such a volatile environment that can be gorgeous and enthralling one minute and then, you know, testing and challenging the next. And I was telling a friend this the other day, you can't complain to the manager and demand a refund. You just have to deal with what you're given that day and just get tougher and each dive by dive. And that kind of really crossed over well into the long, lonely hours that go into, you know, writing, organizing, and especially editing such a large project like that. Cause it's not like a TikTok video where you just, you know, do it in a few hours and then that's it. This is something that took about 17 months of my life and a lot of sacrifice to add to that. But in the end, I don't really regret it because a lot of the people who I admire in this world are the ones who kind of gave the middle finger to playing it conservative and like, you know, doing what had already been done before. And I just knew that if I didn't challenge myself, then I would regret it for years to come.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you've got to give it a go. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only by giving it a go, you know, whether it's going to be a good one or a bad one.
Yeah.
You know, the situation, I mean. And if it's a bad one, then you just move it alongside and jog on to the next one, don't you?
Exactly, just like a dive.
So have you been diving lately? Or are you?
I did dive a couple of weeks ago. I was in the Mornington Peninsula doing a bit of rebreather training, and I had a really pleasant experience diving with some friends, both in the piers as well as the, excuse me, the wrecks that are down there. And, but I had to take a few weeks off to, start working on the next feature film, but I'll be diving this weekend with Ryan. So that's, yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
Dr. Douche.
Anything but a douche.
Gotta give him a shout out. Any
shout out to Ryan Douchatel.
Yeah, good man. So what's that, what is it you got coming up? What training is it?
My next feature film is a little similar, but it's also in many ways different. It's a documentary about award-winning cave diver Jill Hyneth. Now, for those of you who don't know who Jill Hyneth is, she's pretty much been a real trailblazer in the cave diving world. And it's some of the stories that she – we've already filmed like a small portion of it on camera so far, but some of the stories that she told were absolutely mind-boggling. And the thing that I find most fascinating about her story is that usually, like, when you ask a diver, why do you do it? They'll usually give you, like, one kind of response, which in some ways was what happened with Descent, is that it was a very simple, clear reason why Kiki did what she did.
Mm.
But with Jill, the reasons for being a cave diver are a lot more complex and, pardon the pun, deeper than most are. And I just found that, you know, character development that goes through her story to be really fascinating for me as a storyteller. And without saying too much about what we're up to, I can easily say that this is the most fun that I've ever had on a project, not just in the diving world, but also in my film career so far.
Yeah, yeah. And have you started filming already, or is it still in the planning phases?
So we already shot – this is and to anyone who's curious about how the documentary process works, what I usually do is I interview the subject first so that I can get the story down pat, which we've already done so far. And then we return to film all the observational footage, or in this case, dive sequences. And that's usually – a lot harder because of how logistically complex it is. And some of the cave dives that we're doing, this has been a really fun challenge because free diving is a very simple thing to order. But when you're dealing with, you know, rebreathers, overhead environments, large shot lists, and, you know, taking safety more into account in that regard, it's a fun game of chess to just like move all those pieces and figure out how you can get what you want while also being safe.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Excuse me.
Bless you.
I think you're probably in good hands with Jill anyway, aren't you?
Yeah, Jill. Well, the thing that I really admire about Jill is that she is really experienced on both sides of the camera. So that means that whenever I say I want X, Y, Z, she says, I know exactly what I need to do to get you what you want. And yeah. It's I have nothing but positive things to say about her.
Makes life a lot easier, right? I used to work with her, a videographer when I was teaching all the time.
And, oh yeah,
yeah. Controlling 5-6 people at a time, newbies, and him trying to record it. Just having that experience behind and in front of the camera, and just a little nod in either direction, and knowing exactly what's going to happen next.
Yeah,
works a treat.
Well, that's the thing with shooting underwater, is that all the things that, you know, normal filmmakers take for granted, you know, like communication, lighting, props, gravity, and all that stuff, all that goes away underwater. So it's very much like it's the opposite of working with a blank canvas, in the sense that you have to really adapt to whatever's going with you. But in many ways, I actually like that challenge of having to work with less, and I often find that the rewards are much more sweeter because of how, you know, how you have to like work with those obstacles and really pull something out of it.
Yeah, fair one. So what's the have you got a master plan for your diving, or is it going in a particular direction? Is there something that's —
what do you mean by that?
Well, are you aiming to be, you know, because a lot of people that go on to tech diving and CCRs, they have a fascination for either going deep or into caverns or into wreck exploration.
Oh, I love this question. Mm. You know, like, for me, like, I realized that the, you know, diving industry wasn't necessarily like the right thing for me. I love the meditation side of diving and that aspect of mental health, but that being said, I also love the potential of exploring more and getting out of that comfort zone bit by bit. So now that I've crossed over into the rebreather world, obviously caves and wrecks are on my list. I'm not really interested in like the hardcore stuff where you're really squeezing through more than a kilometer inside
the caves. Yeah, we'll leave that to Stephen Fowler.
Yeah. And also, I'm an only child and my parents have repeatedly told me, don't do anything really stupid. But the thing is that what really appeals to me, other than just, you know, shooting underwater, like there's a lot of there's really just like a lot of places that I want to go to that I haven't been to, and really just you know, taking cameras down there and making something out of it. And I really I can't remember when this really started, but I really love going to like the unknown, underrated destinations that not many tourists go to, and really just you know, experiencing that silence and that unspoiled aspect of it. Like, for instance, I recently went to a few parts in Tasmania earlier this year where it's as remote as it can get with dive support. And it was really interesting seeing like an underwater environment in Australia that few people talk about, and just really getting a taste of, you know, turning around the corner. And that's kind of what I really love doing, is just like going into, whether it's like literally with the dives or metaphorically with the stories, just exploring new territory.
Have you got is there any kind of location? Well, just to finish that one off, I suppose what you're saying there is that the rebreather side of things and the cave training, etc. Yes. etc. is a tool that's going to be used for your cinematography, yeah?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the thing for me, this goes not just for dime, but like anything, film, music, editing, you name it. I really make a point of focusing on tools that are just versatile, reliable all-rounders. And for me, ever since getting into the rebreather, I've really appreciated how it is so applicable for many different scenarios. Like, it goes well for wrecks, caves, but especially, you know, like big animals that are skittish, as well as also if you're on a film shoot, rather than having to change your tanks four times a day, you can stay in there for like twice. And like, not even, I've been on some shoots where I haven't even had to change my scrubber because it's so shallow and also efficient to do. But I would like to, you know, go deeper than the normal recreational limits, and I'm working my way towards that. But as you probably know, that's something that takes time. And it's an interesting thing. Like, where do you draw the line? And I think that there is no universal, you know, stopping point for everyone. Like, everyone will say, okay, I'm happy with this at a different depth. For some people, it might be 200 meters, or others it might be 20 meters, but I haven't yet decided that part of how far I want to go. But what I do know is that as far as locations go, I'm definitely hungry for more in that regard.
Yeah And you'll find your own route and where you want to go and explore, for sure. But you hit on a key thing there, and that's experience. You know, take your time, and but take baby steps. You know, you see quite a few people just jumping at the deep end literally quickly and just end up being on an audit sheet.
Oh, yeah. I remember like when I first got into not only scuba diving but also free diving, that was kind of like this generation where there was no like zero to hero dive master program. And especially in the free diving world, I remember a lot of athletes of that era who have actually become friends now, they made a point of taking their time and really slowly progressing. And I actually got my freediving instructor license in the first year of COVID lockdowns, which was a really interesting experience. But freediving is like a really interesting, you know, counterpart to all those like the normal scuba and rebreather stuff. But for me, like freediving is, I think it was Kirk Kruk who said that if scuba diving is like taking your car and driving through the forest with your music on, then free diving is like jogging through that forest with no music. Okay. And what at least I interpret that is that it really means that you're really looking within and just like being very introspective, because when you're diving without a camera, but that's an important disclaimer, when you're either competition diving or recreational free diving without a camera, you are very much meditating and internalized with your mind, where the outside world just disappears and you just need to focus with not focus, but actually just control your thoughts and achieve that stillness.
So as I understand it, you do the bits in the pool to get, what's it called, apnea?
Oh, yeah, dynap. So the way that freediving works is that there are really six disciplines, three in the pool, three in the ocean. So the three ones in the pool, just to start you off with that, is the first is called static apnea, which is when you lie face down in the water and try to hold your breath as long as you can. Mm-hmm. The second one, the other two are called dynamic apnea with fins and dynamic apnea without fins. And obviously, dynamic with fins, without fins, is when you will swim as many laps underwater in the pool without it. And mm-hmm. with fins, you can either use a monofin, which are those fancy dolphin-shaped tails that the competitor divers want, or just two bifins, whether it's snorkeling or the carbon fins. Now, depth is a different game because you're not focusing on distance. You're focusing on depth. So all the three disciplines are constant weight, just meaning that whatever weight you will take with you down there, you have to bring back up. So the first is called constant weight, which is when you will dive with either fins or like a monofin or bifins, similar to dynamic. Mm-hmm. The second is called constant weight no fins, which is similar to dynamic no fins, is a modified underwater breaststroke. And then the last one is called free immersion, which is when you're pulling up and down a rope to get down there. And a lot of divers will have particular preferences for which disciplines they like in the pool and in the depth. But the main thing is that those disciplines are really – it's easy to look at that and just think, okay, that's all there is to it in freedom, like just competing to see who can go. But the truth is there is another side to it, like the more recreational, meditative side, which is I think what draws even more people to it than – you know, seeing how far or how deep you can go.
Mm, yeah. I mean, there's got to be something about it. I mean, I've never been and never will call myself a freediver, but clearly as a young kid, we didn't scuba dive. So we used to duck dive, you know, whether it's 15, 20 meters, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's just so serene, you know, and I love diving for the fact of being underwater. But then you eliminate that bubble noise and mm-hmm. that scuba noise. And yeah, into the freediving world, other than not being able to breathe, obviously.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, is that that experience of like duck diving in the pool that we have as kids, a lot of pretty much every freediver I've ever spoken to has cited that as like a formative childhood experience where it just stuck in the back of their mind until they did it. But I don't know whether you shoot on, but I find that freediving is also a really effective tool for getting the shot, because sometimes, like, rather than having to take equipment down and like be limited with bottom times, in the case of freediving, depending on what you're doing, that is, you can swim up and down hundreds of times a day to get it, and also it just means that you have a much slimmer profile in the water, which for certain situations is really handy.
Well, we did an expedition out to South Africa back in 2018 to do the sardine run, and you know, you go out on the on the rub, on the duck, whatever you want to call them, the zodiac, for about 7 hours a day. And I would say of the entire week that we were there, we put the dive equipment on maybe three times. The rest of the time, it was literally get in the water and get there now. And all the actions are near the surface.
Yeah.
So when it came to actually using cameras and getting a sight on what we wanted to watch, it was all duck diving. It was all shallow, you know, maximum 10 meters, I reckon.
Yeah.
So if you're into your big stuff, I would highly recommend going out there for 4 or 5 days and just trying to get the sardine run with all the sharks and the, especially when the whales come up as well.
Oh, it's on my list. I'd love to go down there for sure.
Yeah. Well, when you do, I've got a company out there, Rob and Debbie of Offshore Africa out of Port St. John's. They are fantastic and their team is awesome. So a big shout out to those guys as well. But I'll give you the details.
I'll put it on my phone as soon as we end.
I'll tell you what we haven't mentioned yet is the fact that you are speaking at Oztech.
Yes, I am.
Nervous?
Yes and no. I mean, Oztech is really, Oztech was like another really formative experience for me because first of all, that's where I met Jill, but it's also where I met a lot of other legends in the world and just watching what they were, you know, doing and like understanding their motivations behind why they were doing what they were doing. Seeing all those, legends at Oztech really catalyzed that idea within me of why do people do what they do. And it really opened my eyes to how the thrill and adventure is obviously one appealing, but the human spirit and the, you know, character side of it is even more intriguing. And I think it's what people who aren't in our diving world find the most interesting when they look at it from an outsider's perspective. And to be able to return 5 years later where it all began for me is something that I'm really privileged to be a part of, and I'm very excited to be going there.
G'day listeners, Rod the producer here. Just wanted to take 30 seconds and highlight that Scuba Goat is working with Oztech, so you can purchase your tickets direct from the show notes. Matt's going to be at the show both days. Don't forget to drop by and say hi and see if he's carrying any free goodies. Finally, if you don't already, we'd appreciate a follow, like, or share via social media. Whether Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook as you go, you can search for Scuba Goat or click the links in the show notes. We'll see you there.
Well, without giving too much away, I'm assuming that you're going to be talking about video and camera work.
You can say that.
But you can't. It's a secret. No, I reckon it's going to be a really good weekend.
Yeah. Did you see the lineup that they just updated? I was just looking at it the other day and I was like, oh my God, this is astonishing. Like, how lucky are we?
Yeah. I can't even, do you know how many numbers there are now? Is it 40 odd? 40, 43, 46?
I lost count.
Yeah, likewise. Likewise. Let me see if I can have a quick look. You're obviously staying down there for the full weekend, eh?
Well, I'm doing the cave course with Ryan a few days beforehand, and then this is how hectic that period is. I'm driving down to Gambia to do the course, then driving from Gambia to Melbourne for Oztech, then driving from Melbourne to Sydney, then hopping on a flight to Vancouver literally hours later.
Vancouver?
Because that's and then to Ottawa to begin filming again with Jill.
Bloody hell.
Tell me.
Busy boy.
Oh, and I have to lug around my JJ and my cameras with that the whole time. So
Are you taking them to Vancouver as well?
Well, the thing is that we go to Mexico right after Ottawa. So I know that there are some guys that will ship their units to certain locations they're doing. I've had a lot of nightmares with shipping, so I'm not taking that risk. I'm taking it with me the whole time.
That's going to cost you a fortune.
Yeah, no thank you.
So you're heading to Tulum?
Yeah.
Nice. How long are you there for?
A whole month.
What?
Yeah, it's that's – I was – you know how we were talking earlier about how hectic the cave diving shoots are? Well, the thing is that there are so many different setups, but they also take so long. And because it's my first time there, I need time to prepare and just get used to the area. And it it's easily like the most complex thing that I've ever had to organize and plan out as a diving filmmaker.
And you've got all your bods, you've got all your people for lighting, etc. Do you know where you're staying yet?
Not yet, but I can tell you who we're diving with. Do you know the guys at Under the Jungle?
Under the Jungle.
Natalie Gibb and Vince over there.
Yeah, I don't know them personally. I know the name.
They're sure. I've been working with them for a few months already in prep, and I, similarly to Jill, like I've just had an absolute blast setting things up. Like it's very similar, professional, detail oriented. I really have a lot of respect for them.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you'll enjoy it out there.
Have you been before?
Yeah, we did. This is again just before. No, it wasn't just before 2019. We did, me and the missus, we did 5 weeks down, going from Galapagos up through Mexico into Cozumel.
Oh, nice. I haven't done Cozumel either, but I have done Galapagos. Which liveaboard did you go with for that one?
Oh, we were on Galapagos Sky.
Interesting. I haven't heard of those ones yet.
That's beautiful. Yeah, really nice.
Nice.
And you?
Master.
Yeah, well, I'm on Master next year. I've got an expedition in July next year.
Oh, no kidding. Are you the trip leader or someone else?
Yeah, it's my
fantastic.
My boat.
I'd love to do a rebreather trip because I went there on scuba, obviously, but I've seen some footage of the rebreather expeditions that they run there where they're just so much closer to the hammerheads and all the other skittish animals. And I'm not going to lie to you. Like it's just, it's something that appears in my nightly showreel of dreams very regularly. So
it's a beautiful sight.
Yeah.
And you managed to see them, obviously.
Yes. Yeah. That's a fun story. I think you'll like, it was actually on the last day. We were in an area where you actually aren't supposed to see hammerheads. I think it was San Cristobal. But anyway, we were looking for eagle rays, and then I see this large black shadow go over me, and I'm like, what's this? And it turns out it's a school of 100 hammerheads just soaring over me, and I just remember holding the camera. I know you're not supposed to hold your breath when you're scuba diving, but I was just like, screw it. I'm not letting this shot go to waste. So I just filmed them. And then 12 seconds later, I let out the bubbles, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
All of them just vanished within a second.
Yeah.
But that was a really special moment for me because it really felt like that it was very similar to what I had seen on Blue Planet all those years ago. And it felt like everything came full circle at that moment for a brief window.
Yeah. It's a very, very special place. I mean, obviously it's a Galapagos, so it is special for, you know, more reasons than just us looking at fish. But, you know, the missus, my missus, she had her moment there, which was, you know, on the drifting away from Darwin's Arch on the strongest currents that she'd been in and sitting on a safety stop with dolphins over the top and hammerheads underneath and tears in her mask.
No way.
Yeah, she was so emotional. It was fantastic. A beautiful place in the world. So I came back off that trip and got in touch with Master Liveaboard straight away and said, right, let's get a boat together. And then COVID kicked in. So this one's been waiting for over 2 years now.
Wow.
But we've moved it to July next year. There's a couple of spaces left if anybody wants to come. But we're hoping for it's kind of July is the crossover period.
Oh yeah,
for the mantas and whale sharks. So obviously we're going to get the hammerheads, but hopefully we'll get some big bus size whale sharks as well.
Oh yeah,
just tee it off.
I hear that the whole July to October season, and for anyone who's listening, please correct me. Apparently that's when all the pregnant females start coming, and it's rumored that that's where they breed, but no one's seen it on camera. So
yeah, it's never been captured on camera. And even Simon Pierce from Marine Megafauna Foundation, when we were talking about it,
yeah,
they have no clue where they give birth. I can only assume that they go down real deep and in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. One of my friends posted this National Geographic chart of where all the shark species live in the various, you know, depths, where it's like twilight zone, dark zone, all that stuff. And apparently the whale sharks love, they often will hang out like up to 1600 meters deep. And I was just like, well, that's fascinating, because I had always thought of these of whale sharks as like kind of surface dwelling because of how many pictures you see of them right there. So to see that they will venture that deep was something that was like, oh, this is interesting.
Yeah Well, that kind of makes sense though, because they're pretty crappy on the eyesight, aren't they?
I've only seen them once before in the middle of the night, but I haven't seen them in during the daytime yet.
Okay. Yeah. No, they're I don't think and again, the guys out there can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. They've not got the greatest of eyesight. No. So that says to me that, you know, if they're not dominant on the eyesight, then they tend to, you know, be a deep dweller.
Speaking of which, you know what's one shark with bad eyesight that I really, really would give anything to see?
Go on.
The Greenland shark.
Oh, yeah.
Or the sleeper. Like, those two sharks from the Somniosis family is... Oh, my God.
And but I feel sorry for the Greenlands, though, because they lose their eyesight because of a freaking parasite.
Yeah, those copepods are just bastards. But they just are the most... I just find, like, there's just one of those sharks where it's different from like the other ones, where sometimes their behavior is like a little more, but these ones are just so, not only are they so but they just look so strange, as if they're something from a science fiction movie. And there's an episode from the BBC series Shark where they film them, you know, venturing like under the pack, I think it's the pack ice, and the way that they're just juxtaposed against like that icy blue, and you see this like giant 6 meter cigar shaped shark just come out. Oh my God. I would, if anyone's listening who runs Greenland shark diving, hit me up, because I'll be first in line.
Yeah, fair one. There was one rocked up down in the Bahamas or something a few months ago.
Really?
Was it the Bahamas? It was somewhere off the coast of America.
That's insane.
And it was very tropical. But they thought it was a Greenland shark. But they're, I looked into those quite a bit, because they don't mature for 150 years.
No, I was talking to Chris Harvey Clark, who's one of the leading scientists on them. And he said that apparently they can live as long as 500 years.
It's crazy, isn't it?
So it's amazing how it's. I think it's like something that happens a lot with deep sea. Like, I don't know what it is about deep sea gigantism, and scientists, I'd want to hear more about this if you're listening, but apparently they live so much longer than their shallow water cousins, but also they grow a lot larger than them as well. But that's one concept that I'd love to learn more about.
Yeah. Yeah, I just found it online there. It wasn't Bahamas, it was Belize.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it was a report came in August this year.
There's that amazing blue hole over there that just looks like anything could be down there, so who knows what else is lurking.
Have you been out there yet?
No, I really want to go, though.
I would, excuse me, I would suggest that the best bit of the Belizean blue hole is actually from the air looking down at it.
Really?
Yeah. And then the coral reefs surrounding it are probably better than the hole itself. It's pretty dull on the inside. I'll probably get shot for that, but c'est la vie.
we're in a world where we can get shot for anything, so bring it.
Yeah. No, I really enjoyed Belize. We stayed there for, I think it was 9 or 10 days.
Really?
Nice. Yeah. And there was a great little team on San Pedro as well.
Awesome.
Good little diving outfit. And some beautiful dives. Yeah. but then going further up to Cozumel. And I was surprised because, you know, I expected Cozumel to be kind of battered because it's a bit of a tourist hotspot.
Yeah.
But there's some lovely drift dives and some nice soft corals and plenty of spacious swim-throughs as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yeah, nice place. I'd certainly go back.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, well, I mean, you're going to be stuck in caves and caverns, aren't you, for a month?
Well, it is, going back to like, that the interesting thing is that, you know, for me, like, I remember around the same time I watched Blue Planet, I also watched, Planet Earth, where I remember in the caves episode, they show these two divers venturing into the really deep cenotes that are blacked out and have halocynes. And I remember seeing that as a kid thinking, oh my God, this is terrifying. Why would anyone do this? And then cut to 17, 18 years later, and here I am doing that very same thing. And I just think that, you know, the challenge of it and just like forcing yourself to, you know, overcome that initial apprehension and fear is just something that I think is like, it's not only fascinating, but the after effects of it, like the savoring that feeling of just conquering your inner fears is something I really like a lot.
Yeah. 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 I think it's one of those things that I've said it before. It's for certain people, not for all people.
Oh yeah.
And, I mean, when we did Tulum, we just did it as, you know, fun divers.
Yeah.
And we did a couple of dives. Quite honestly, I think I would have been better off going deeper inside to have a bit more exploration.
Okay.
However, because it was quite spacious, I found myself getting a little bit bored very quickly. Because yeah. I'm like you, I love having a camera in my hand and I need something to take a photo of, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And on the flip side, the missus, a super comfortable diver. But after, I think, dive three or four, she was kind of, yeah, I've had enough of this.
Interesting.
You know? Yeah.
Well, for me, like, sometimes the camera can be a bit of a nuisance, especially on the rebreather, because it's, so as I was mentioning with, you know how you asked me about what's the mindset of freediving? Well, in... When you're diving with a camera, not just freediving, but any kind of diving, it's the opposite. It's very much externalized where it's just like, okay, is a shot in frame? Is it in focus? Is the light right? Is the color right? Like you have all these problems that are just coming at you a million miles an hour. And sometimes like it can get so overstimulating and overwhelming just doing all that you just want to you know, throw the camera away and just enjoy it for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. There is that. I did find myself turning my light off because I was just following everyone. tail end Charlie. Happy for them to be, you know, up with the guide.
Yeah.
And turning my light off and swimming and just following the lights. It was quite serene, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then as your eyes adjust, I started trying to look down on the floor to see if there's any, dropped items, any GoPros.
For sure. Yeah.
So your camera.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big unit, isn't it?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I used to shoot a lot with red cameras and the housings for those can get very chunky. But the other thing is that they, in addition to requiring a lot more attention to detail and alertness, they also can be very, what's the word, capricious in the sense that sometimes they'll overheat, sometimes the menu system will crap out on you, sometimes they just, I don't know what it is, but for me, like when I decided to go over into the rebreather world, I realized that I needed something that was smaller and obviously, because you've already got 40 kilos of equipment on you already. But the other thing is that from a, you know, safety point of view, I needed something that would not distract me and was easy to take in with me. And if I ever had to, you know, manage something, then it would be easy. And I really admire all the older pros who will take not just like, you know, Reds, but RELX is like all the big fancy cinema cameras that cost as much as a car.
Yeah.
To be able to operate. That is something that that I really respect in those guys.
Yeah. So what are you shooting on now then?
My current camera is a Sony A7S III, although I'm really hoping that Sony releases a new camera that's somewhere similar to what the cinema cameras are, but is smaller and more versatile. And it's not as you have to kind of search harder to find like the dream housing and the dream camera. There are certain tools that will and I think this goes back to what we were talking to earlier, but there is no like universal camera that is the best for, like, what is the best thing for me is probably the worst thing for you and vice versa.
Yeah. I find that as well, because I've got a lot of friends that, for, you know, they shoot with Nikon or Sony.
Yeah.
I'm a Canon guy.
Okay.
It's just, it's what works for me.
Yeah.
And same for like Don Silcock, who comes on the show every now and then when he's in the country. Mm-hmm. He's off shooting crocodiles, not shooting, but filming crocodiles, taking photographs of crocodiles at the moment. But he's a massive advocate for Nikon.
Yeah.
But I think it's that thing that you get used to a particular tool.
Exactly.
And it becomes second nature, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I'm also a creature of habit as well. So, yeah. I really admire cameramen that can just pick up anything and just use it like they've been using it for 30 years.
Yeah. That is not me. I recently moved on to this latest acquisition. What was it? Maybe August, September last year, and it's taken me a good 4 or 5 months just to, even though it's the same brand, just to get used to the handling of this one. But it's good fun. I like it.
Yeah. I mean, it really just depends on also not just what you're shooting on, but what you're shooting on camera. Like, the thing for me is that I often venture into low light environments, like whether it's caves or night dives or even sometimes a low vis dive here in New South Wales.
We've got a few of those, eh?
Oh, yeah. but it's also just like, it really just like depends on what is on camera. And, you know, this is something that I'm guilty of that I'm trying to get better at, is that you can't really get too caught up in the tech. Like, I try to focus more on like the story of the image that's being told, rather than, you know, how fancy my rig is and like what I need to get that. And I have a couple of friends throughout Australia who have used simple point and shoot cameras and housings. The whole setup is barely $1,000, and some of the shots that they've gotten on that look like the things that you'd see in a, like, the best of the best National Geographic photo, like, coffee table books. And it just shows you how it really isn't the tool, it's the artist behind it.
Yeah. Sensei.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about Sensei, because they've literally only just launched, hasn't it?
Yeah, they just launched a few days ago. That was something that only came in earlier this year, where through some of the clients that I had been working with on dry land before, they knew that I was really into the underwater, and they recommended it to the guys at Sensei, who had this idea to make a really extracurricular learning platform where you combine online courses with, you know, real in-person activities. And they said, would you be willing to, you know, point us in the right direction for, you know, diving stuff and under. And I said, sure thing. However I can help, I'm in. And, I'm really interested to see where they go with it. I mean, it's still early days, and I haven't had as large a role as some of the other team members, but, I'm hopeful for where Sensei will go in the future.
You put me in touch with them, and I had a good chat with Sam on the phone about it.
Uh-huh.
And to be honest, I wasn't sure what kind of input I could give them, because it's effectively it's real world education that you can't receive through you know, your standard education, high school, university, that kind of thing. Exactly. So cooking, diving,
yoga,
whatever it is. And they're building, let's say, like a portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure. So we kind of concluded, it was like, okay, we'll leave it for now. But I've had a think afterwards, you know, and there's a few ideas that I've got for them. So
yeah,
we'll have a little chat with them again at some point later in the week. But no, very best of luck to them.
Yeah. Well, if anyone's the man to do it with, you know, how to do a podcast or anything that you're else that you're interested, then you're the man to do it.
Oh, shucks. Cheers, buddy.
No worries.
Yeah. Mate, it's that time of day.
What time is it again?
Beer o'clock. folks, thanks very much for listening. Nays, thanks for being on the show, and very best of luck in Tulum.
Thank you so much for having me, mate.
All the best for the future, and I'll see you down at Oztec.
See you there. Bye for now.
Cheers, guys. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
This is Scuba Go Go Under the Sea, the podcast for the inquisitive diver.